Hi there, it's Nick here. Thanks so much for your support of the Daily Podcast as we charge headlong to our 1000th episode on May the 13th. As I might have told you before, one of the great places you can pick up the Daily Podcast is on the Racing app. It really couldn't be simpler, and it's a brilliant interface to go all the way back through the episode should you need to. If you are, like I am, and you know I am, a huge fan of US horse racing and you live outside the United States, the Racing app is also the best place to consume all your US racing. Not only the cards, which are dead straightforward to use and pick up, but also past performances for the horses running today that you want to go back and have a look at so you can decide how you want to play tonight's racing. For example, if you want to look at a horse in the 6:20 Aqueduct this evening and you want to back Chateau, you can click on the horse's name and it brings up all the past performances at one click. It's a terrific resource. If you do love American racing and you are outside the United States, the Racing app is the place you need to be. You're listening to Nick Luck Daily. This edition is brought to you by Timeform, the trusted source of racing data and analysis. By the Racehorse Owners Association. And by the Racing app, in partnership with FitzDares. Good morning, welcome to the show. It is Friday, March the 22nd, the sort of day here in TW11 that suggests that winter just will not bugger off. Let's hope it does soon. We're taking you around the globe in this episode. We hear from a rookie trainer, British-born but now Australian-based, who's just had his first winner. By the sounds of him, it'll be the first of many. We hear in a lengthy interview with esteemed journalist Ray Pawlik about the very real threat to racing in California that only intensified in a vote at the Californian Horse Racing Board yesterday. It's a fascinating story and one that you really have to wake up and take note of. That a little later in the show. To South Africa we head for the latest on the untimely death of Marcus Uster, who it appears has taken his own life, once one of the most powerful men in not just South African racing, but in global racing as well. Kieran Fallon Jr. is along in a few moments' time. He makes his comeback today. He wants you to pray for a man who he can call a dear friend and is very close to his family, Stefano Kirky, who is in a critical condition in hospital in Canberra. But first of all, let's start with the news today that Norwich City footballer Ashley Barnes has been warned off indefinitely by the British Horse Racing Authority. Lydia Hislop is with me this morning. Lydia, this was a story that was broken by David Yates and John Lees in the Daily Mirror. What do we know?
Not a great deal, because essentially he has been indefinitely disqualified or excluded, which means he can't set foot on licensed premises such as racecourses or training yards, by the British Horse Racing Authority for failing to cooperate into the British Horse Racing Authority investigation into the Hilsin case, which we've covered extensively on the podcast. That was the horse that finished third under Dylan Kitts when trained by Chris Honor, owned by Alan Clegg, in a conditional jockey's hand in a conditional jockey's hurdle at Worcester. Investigation are ongoing with that. We know that, and the latest news from the case is that both professional footballer Ashley Barnes and his father-in-law John Higgins, who is based in the southwest, that they have both been excluded for the same thing, failing to cooperate, which we don't know many more details than that. Quite often it can be to do with failing to produce evidence such as telephone records.
There is no suggestion that the BHA is any closer to concluding this case. The BHA wasn't going to offer any further comment because they tend not to comment when it's an ongoing investigation. But they have confirmed that both Ashley Barnes is indeed the Norwich City footballer, and that John Higgins is not John Higgins of any notoriety, but is John Higgins, as you say, from the southwest. They are both listed on the BHA's website, and they are both, the BHA has confirmed, linked to the same inquiry. The BHA will not confirm that it is the Hilsin inquiry, but it is widely understood that that is the case. And indeed, that has been named by Peter Scargill in the Racing Post today, who is following up the original exclusive by John Lees and David Yates in the Daily Mirror, that story breaking overnight. I have spoken to Norwich City Football Club this morning. Clearly, this was news to them as well overnight. They said their first duty of care was to the player, who is a full-time member of their staff, want to make sure, given the scrutiny and the publicity, that that player is okay. And clearly thereafter, there was a responsibility to the club and to the integrity of the club to get to the bottom of what has occurred. But it was too early to speculate beyond that. Come back today for Kieran Fallon, who's been out of the saddle for some months. And Kieran joins me now. Kieran, just tell me the nature of the injury. It was quite a nasty one, wasn't it?
Yeah, look, it was a freak accident, I suppose. The city's gone down and we got stuck. I tore my ACL, MCL, cracked my ankle, tore the ligaments and tendons in my ankle as well. And, you know, in the rehab, had a few little setbacks, but the last couple of weeks, things have been looking well.
And you come back with a slate cleaned, if you like, because you're starting pretty much a new phase of your career. Just explain who you're going to be riding for mainly and what your intentions are this year.
Yeah, it's going to be a change for this year, being freelance as a professional. Mr. Haggis is going to be my main support. I'll be second jockey behind Tom in here riding out every day. The other day, just text a couple of trainers asking to ride out, see where we're at and see if, you know, you can try and get in as many stables as I can, try and get as much support as I can. Octa's back this year, so please God, he can perform again. So my main aim for this year is, you know, to try and get on the big days, the big winners, and try and ride as many winners as I can and hopefully get the 100 winner mark.
And you had that second job for Qatar Racing. I guess, in all honesty, there's not really a big enough body of horses to sustain a second rider there. Is that going to free you up a little bit?
Yeah, definitely. Shape 5 and the Okata team were, you know, very supportive and understood the decision. Still will be riding for them this year. But being tied down as second jockey, like you said, there's just not as many horses. And, you know, being tied down and just waiting for Oisin to find out where he's going, etc., etc., just held me back because I wasn't really being able to commit to rides. But now I'll be able to commit straight away.
Now, I know today your thoughts first will be with Stefano Kirky, who, in addition to being a valued weighing room colleague, is also the partner of your sister Brittany, and who, as we told everybody yesterday, was in a very serious condition in hospital in Canberra.
Yeah, look, it was a freak accident. The other two jockeys, frankly, walked away okay. Horses unscathed as well, which is nice. But unfortunately for Stefano, he suffered a very, very nasty incident. He's not in a good way, but we're all praying. So this is, you know, I'm asking everyone in racing to come together as a community and pray for him. It's a hard time for me and the family, but, you know, if we've got everyone supporting us and praying, so please God, he can pull through.
Kieran Fallon there, wonderful to welcome him back to the saddle, but clearly his mind is going to be on many things today, and uppermost in his mind is Stefano Kirky, and that comment can be echoed for all of us, really, Lydia. This sounds a horrible fall, and all we can do is keep our fingers crossed, and as Kieran said, please everyone, just pray for him.
Yeah, absolutely. Pray or think or set aside some time to think about Stefano, who's a really lovely young man. I don't claim to know him that well, but I have media trained him a couple of times when he first came over from Sardinia to get his jockey's license, and also when he lost his claim as well, some further training. And that's when I got to know him a little bit better. He is a really lovely young person, and obviously everybody will be having their fingers crossed for him and hoping that he's able to pull through what has happened to him.
It is good to see Kieran Fallon back in the saddle. That was a series of very nasty injuries that he himself has had to get over through the winter. Can he get his career back on track this year, do you think?
I think so. I mean, we all know that he's a great talent. He's been the conditional champion. He's ridden some high profile races. He had the high profile tie up, which he no longer has, and I think it could be a a new lease of life, really, the recovery from injury. And quite often, interesting in talking to jockeys, they often seem to say that as a result of having to react to a serious setback, such as those kind of injuries, that the whole process of recovery means that they actually come back, you know, even fitter than they could have imagined that they were previously. They're, you know, Kieran will also be particularly determined to get his name back at the forefront of most people's thoughts, most trainers' thoughts, people who can supply him with rides, owners. And I think very much so, I think he can have a very, very strong season. In fact, I go so far as to say I'd expect him to.
Yeah, and lovely to hear that Oxted is going to be back as well. A horse I've pretty much forgotten about. So
yeah, that was great news. Really, really, really good. I'm very, very fond of him too.
Well, yesterday the California Horse Racing Board agreed by a 6-0 majority to enable the Pleasanton Fairs Meet in Northern California to stage horse racing. Nothing, normally speaking, unusual you'd think about this, but the context is much broader, much more significant, as Ray Pawlik from the Pawlik Report is about to explain. For people who haven't been following this story, Ray, what was at stake yesterday?
Well, what's at stake really is the future of racing in California, and it's been percolating for a long time, and I think it finally spilled over in this meeting, thanks in part to a letter from the owners of Santa Anita a couple of days ago that said, look, if you allocate more racing dates in Northern California, we may have to consider what other land use we have at Santa Anita, because it's no longer financially viable to operate race meets in both Southern California mm-hmm. and Northern California. There's not enough horses to go around. And frankly, there's not enough money to go around, because California is one of the last American, you know, racing circuits that doesn't get money from slot machines, casinos, or some other form of gambling. That's what's made Kentucky racing so strong. It's made racing in Arkansas, and it's propped up racing in New York and Florida. California doesn't have that. The only revenue they get is from the sale of a pari-mutuel ticket.
And so first, formerly the Stronach Group, who own Santa Anita and own Gulfstream Park and have been running racing in Maryland for a long time as well, they were operating Golden Gate Fields, and everybody knows they shut that down. That's in Northern California. The idea being that those horses from Northern California would migrate down south to Santa Anita and then in the off-season to Del Mar to shore up the field sizes in Southern California, and it was a consolidation exercise. That was their theory, right?
Well, that was part of the theory, but really I think the more important part of the theory is that California has a peculiar law that if you're in Northern California and you can bet on Southern California races, and all of the revenue from that bet goes to Northern California. So what I think the game was to close down racing in Northern California so that all of the revenue from betting on simulcasting, whether it's on Southern California races or around the country, that revenue then would go to the South, and that was going to help make Southern California racing more sustainable. Now, with racing in Northern California, all that money bet stays in the North, and so Southern California is struggling to offer competitive purses for owners.
So then it becomes a double whammy. Given that the vote was lost or won, whichever way you look at it, 6 votes to nothing, how surprised were you that the letter came in from first, from Craig Fravel, who's a seasoned executive in California and, you know, must know just about every single human that's ever had a vote on anything to do with horse racing in the state? How surprised were you that letter of threat of alternative use of Santa Anita came in such close proximity to the vote?
Not really that surprised, because that land at Santa Anita is worth a lot of money. And as a racetrack, they've been losing money. And Belinda Stronach is not her father. Frank Stronach loved horse racing. It was his life, after the car business. But, you know, he loved horse racing. Belinda likes the game, but she's not committed the same way her father is. She's, you know, to her credit, she's invested a lot of money in Santa Anita. They responded to the crisis of a few years ago when horses were breaking down and suffering fatal injuries. They did the extraordinary things there, but, you know, it's a business at the end of the day, and I think she's looking at it and saying to the California Horse Racing Board, look, you make this decision, there may be some consequences, and one of the consequences is we're going to have to look at alternative use for this property.
So how real, then, do you think this threat was, and what do you think happens now?
Well, nothing is going to happen overnight, with the possible exception that they may have to reduce purses even further. They've already cut them a little bit. And as you know, if there's competitive prize money somewhere else, horse owners are going to go there and shoot for the bigger purses. And I think what's going to happen is we're going to see more horses leaving the state, probably less investment in horses to race in California. And they'll start looking at alternative uses for the land. I don't think they're going to shut it down immediately. It's going to take years to do the work that they may end up doing to develop the property.
And is there a sense, do you feel, being quite close to the action, that there could be some sort of halfway house, that the real estate there is so significant, so large, that there can still be alternative uses on that property, which may then help maintain horse racing? I suppose then you also need the horse population.
Yeah, there have been talks over the years of closing the stable area and building a training center somewhere. But yeah, this is Southern California. There's not a lot of excess land to put a training center on, and it's very expensive no matter where you go. So it's a real challenge, and you know, Australia is seeing the same thing happen with some of their tracks. Singapore's closing racing because of some real estate issues. It's a big concern in major cities like Los Angeles and San Francisco. The land that Golden Gate Fields is on is right on the San Francisco Bay, and it's just a beautiful piece of property.
I know you'll have listened to some of the work we've done on this podcast with Mike Rapoli and then Stuart Janney and Lisa Lazarus. And I posed similar questions to all of them about whether American horse racing is greater as a whole than the sum of its parts. I guess this is a very good test of that, isn't it? How do you think the rest of the country, the other major jurisdictions, will respond to this?
Well, I saw an interesting tweet by Mike Rapoli yesterday defending the Stronach Group and saying the rest of the industry needs to try to help California racing, because if you lose it, and it's a very real possibility that it could be lost, there's not just economic pressure, there's public sentiment against racing. He said, if you own horses and we lose California, you've lost one third of your value. And Mike is a smart guy, and you know, if I don't know what the rest of the country can do. What really needs to happen is for California's politicians is to look at what other states have done to help horse racing. Kentucky is the best example, and give them a break and let them put in some form of alternative gaming to support the product.
Because you and I can take a critical view of all sorts of aspects of horse racing, but the one thing we haven't talked about here is the emotional significance of this to an awful lot of people. People who either have made their living at Santa Anita, have wagered at Santa Anita, have visited it once or 100 times or 1,000 times, they'll feel this because it's the sort of place that makes you feel things.
You feel it with every racetrack that you lose, whether it's Suffolk Downs in Boston or Hialeah Park in Florida or Golden Gate Fields. There were people at today's California Horse Racing Board meeting that were weeping over the loss of that track. And you know, it's not easy to see, but Santa Anita is a special place. Anybody who's ever been there knows that, and it has just tremendous history and tremendous value today to the industry.
Ray Pawlik, who spent much of yesterday listening to, I suspect, what was quite a fraught and tightly wound day at the California Horse Racing Board, and then had the good grace to talk me through it in what I thought was a pretty informative primer there, Lydia. If you didn't know anything about the future of California racing 10 minutes ago, you certainly do now. And I'd imagine it was ringing all sorts of alarm bells for you.
Very much so. And I also followed up after listening to him. I went and had a look at the Paulet Report, his blog. You can access it via Twitter on that subject as well, which gives further detail into what he was talking about to you. It really struck me that there are echoes of what California is going through, has really loud echoes for and from Great Britain. On the one hand, a lack of money compared to other states or for us nations, impacting on our comparative prize money and the way in which the Californian state, horse racing in California and Britain, derive their income compared to the way that other jurisdictions, other states derive their income, and that they are better funded. Then, of course, the welfare pressures, creating public debate where modern views that are less favourable to horse racing and the use of animals full stop have more prominence, meaning that politicians are more conflicted when horse racing needs their help. And then there's this tacit pressure on the business with all of these challenging financial futures playing on the business's mind, while also holding on to assets, racecourses, land worth a lot of money in modern society. And it comes down to, you know, what you do next is, you know, is it, do you go down the line of tactical consolidation because you think that that will actually make you stronger in the long run? Or if you do cede ground by, you know, closing racecourses in effect, then is that actually the thin end of the wedge? And I think that is something that Britain is looking at, and clearly it is something that California is looking at. And it, you know, the echoes just were very striking for me.
Yeah, and I wonder now whether somebody in Britain's attitude to tactical consolidation will be different to how it might have been, say, 10, 12 years ago. If, for example, you had that, it's not going to be Kempton anytime soon, but if you had the Kempton conversation that was being had a decade ago now, do you think people would be more ready to not shrug their shoulders, but to say, yeah, actually financially it makes sense to do that, consolidate here, build something stronger here, get bigger fields there? Or do you think that's just still be the same outcry?
A bit of both, really. I mean, in terms of the specifics of Kempton, I think Kempton should never be on the table. Kempton is so fundamental to the future and relevance of British jump racing in terms of the ground that it can produce in midwinter and having horses of a Grade One standard running near London on Boxing Day. There is no other racecourse in the country that can do what Kempton does. And at the moment, obviously, it's a very highly profitable track because of the all-weather racing that it runs. So, I mean, for me, Kempton can never be a good idea, is not a good idea, and should not be on the table. Broadening it more widely, yeah, I think there'll be some people. I mean, there were some voices at the time who were talking about how consolidation could be a good thing, but there are risks that come along with that, in that, you know, will you actually get the opportunity to strategically choose which racecourse it is that you end up without, or will financial circumstances actually force that upon you? So are you able necessarily, particularly given the fact that, you know, different tracks are in different ownerships who have different priorities, you know, is the sport as a whole going to be able to make that tactical decision well? And also, there are risks involved, because at the moment we have racecourses spread largely right across the country, and that actually means that you have a fan base, or certainly an interest base, all across the country. Local communities can get behind their local racecourse, and this applies to training facilities as well, and trainers in the area. There is likely to be a greater understanding of horse racing and the positives of horse racing in an area where there is a racecourse. More of a fan base of people going along there. More obvious links to employment. More tangible understanding of what positive benefits that a racecourse would bring to that community. And if you remove that peg and another peg around the country, that actually has an impact in terms of people who are willing to speak up for horse racing, and that extends all the way down to sort of local debates on a political level, but also representations in Parliament. And it's very easy to see a future whereby decisions for horse racing, I mean, football, I've seen it very, very recently, are made on the floor of the House of Commons. And it's very, very important that racing has a interest base and a fan base and people who understand it across the spread of the country. So it's not as easy as a financial decision, though that's the easy part in many ways. It is the more hard to quantify impacts on the sport in the long term that is the difficult part.
When you talk about racing's fan base, it's rather appropriate that tomorrow we have a a signature race that draws nowhere near the interest that once it did. The William Hill Lincoln takes place at Doncaster. Still a race that I enjoy very much. And I don't know whether that is history just still drawing it to me, because there'll be lots of races just like it all the way through the spring and summer that I probably won't bat an eyelid at. But still, I want to find the winner of the Lincoln.
I'm exactly the same as you. I love the Lincoln. I think it is the right curtain raiser to the flat. I know that increasingly people have said, oh, why don't we start the flat at the Craven? Or why, you know, it, you know, the championship starting with the Guineas and all of that kind of thing, you know, ignoring the fact that the flat carries on all year round anyway. But for me, the Lincoln is very special, and it is a spectacle. And I personally will be tuning in to watch it. And like you, I want to find the winner of the race. And it is special to me. I am a fan of big field handicaps. That is something that is very a sort of signature sight in Britain. And I would not want us to lose that. You know, I was very concerned, you know, at one point about the Spring Mile, which is the sort of sister race to the Lincoln for horses that can't get into the main race. And, you know, when that was looking like it might dwindle, I was very concerned about it, but the Lincoln itself, I think, is a fantastic race, and it will be again. It's you know, I like the Royal Hunt Cup, you know, I like the Bunbury Cup, you know, I do enjoy those kind of races, but I do think there's something very special about the Lincoln.
Okay, the Brocklesby is run tomorrow as well. We spoke with Dominic French Davis earlier in the week. I think I found the winner of the Brocklesby, but that's
how have you done that? We've got no form to go on. Tell me.
Well, indeed, Lydia, you may very well say, how on earth can you pick the winner of the Brocklesby, given the fact we've got absolutely no form to go on, which is where I usher in David Ord, editor of sportinglife.com, with something for the weekend. Because, Dave, you've dived headlong into a pretty shallow pool here. I'm just hoping that this isn't a fatal error.
It could well be, but I have got some assistance through the number crunchers, the data man at Timeform, because they do come up with provisional ratings for unraced horses, two-year-olds in the maids and three-year-olds. It's what they think, looking at breeding connections, trainer record, monthly figures, etc., the sort of number you can expect horses to run to on their debut. And the first test of this untested data is always the Brocklesby. It's always quite interesting, and you won't be surprised to know, Nick, that given the way that things have been going, the ammo machine are responsible for the top rated, and by some way they think Mystical Elegance could run to something like 84. A daughter of Zoo Style, bred to be quick, isn't she? So she comes out on top at 84. She certainly does.
And who else is expected to run well? Because clearly there's going to be a bet somewhere. There's an each way bet in a horse who's too big.
Yeah, and you start looking around. One who's quite interesting at the top, currently about 16-1, is Atherton Warrior for Alice Haynes. That comes out at 73 on breeding. Alice obviously knows time of day with a two-year-old, son of Colsty, 10,000 foot. He's quite highly rated at 73. The one who there's a big buzz about, the dogs are barking for Dukes of Harther, for Adrian Keatley, and Ocean Orr takes the ride for him, Harther's first one. I mean, they'll be dancing on the streets of Shadwell should he have a winner with his first representative in the Brocklesby. He comes out at 69, but he's very strong in the market, and he's the one that people are talking about in the build-up to the race. And there's one other, there's Paddy's Courage for Darrell Holland, and even bigger price, provisional rating of 70, daughter of Dark Angel, another filly in there. She could go well according to these provisional ratings. The favourite's clear, but there probably is a spot of value somewhere else.
David Ord, editor of sportinglife.com, with something for the weekend. Thank you, David.
Thanks, Nick.
Right, the Brocklesby, Lydia, you'll enjoy this, is being run for 40 grand for the first time. 25% of the prize money comes from British stallion owners via the EBF, who have just announced their renewal of £2 million of prize money enhancements across the sport. It's the first of 84 high-value development races for two-year-olds and three-year-olds, supported by a group of racing and breeding industry players, which include Darley, Judmont and Tattersalls. The EBF are supporting 34 of the 84 races, with a total prize money contribution of £325,000. That's got to be a good thing, hasn't it?
No. I think that, obviously, having high value developmental races is really important, but it should really align with the industry, the sport's strategic targets. And at the moment, if we look at European-wide racing or even worldwide racing, I don't think that precocious speed is something that really needs extra incentives being brought in. What does need extra incentivization is middle distance horses, because that is the area, quality middle distance horses, that is the area which we are is under threat and of great concern for the long term relevance of the sport. And there used to be a differential, you know, previously with these sort of high value development races, more money was actually being channeled towards those kind of races that would incentivize the breeding of high quality middle distance horses, because that was deemed to be
more. But aren't they doing less? Aren't Judmont and Darley putting tons of money into developing middle distance races and giving lots of sponsorship to those?
It's the differential that's
sire related maidens and stuff like that later in the year.
But it's the differential is the important part, I think. You know, we know what the problem is, and at the moment we're not targeting the money to where there is the problem. This sort of blanket approach and saying that all developmental races are the same, I don't agree with that. There is a problem, and there needs to be a joined up thinking across the industry that addresses the problem. And you know, as I say, there is no need to incentivize the breeding of precocious speed, because precocious speed is already incentivized by it being something that people want to buy. You know, I think increasingly I worry that what we're doing is breeding horses for the sales ring rather than breeding horses to race, and that way madness and the implosion of the industry lies. Also, precocious speed, particularly when we're talking about 2-year-olds, is already incentivized. It's called Royal Ascot, I don't think those horses and the breeding of those horses need extra help. Philosophically, this industry, this sport, needs to get its ducks in a row and needs to look, you know, pick its eyes up from, you know, in 3-4 months' time or a year's time, and look 10, 20 years down the road and realise that we're heading for a steep precipice.
In the wake of the Cheltenham Festival, but in the growing face of disquiet about inaccuracy in going reports, the Horse Race Bettors Forum, the leading campaign group for punters across Great Britain, is calling for action. Their chair is Sean Trivas, who joins me now. Sean, why are you not happy, and what are we going to do about it?
Well, I think in very simplistic terms, Nick, it's the first thing that I look at when I'm trying to assess a race is what the going is, what horse will act on the ground. Most punters I know do the same thing. And we're being fed, I won't say duff information, inaccurate information, or not accurate enough information. Now, Cheltenham was the sort of nail in the coffin, if you like. Two races described as soft and then changed to heavy with no rain in between. Now, that just suggests that the going stick wasn't used properly or an incorrect decision was reached. I'm sure it wasn't deliberate. No one's accusing anyone of anything. But this has gone on for years. The HPF was formed in 2015. It was one of the first questions asked, could we have better going descriptions, please, or more accurate going descriptions? Here we are coming up for 10 years later, same place as we were. Not good enough, quite frankly. What do you think?
Well, what I think is the interesting part of your argument is not so much can we have more accurate going descriptions, because that's only possible if you have a clerk of the course at each and every one of the race courses that is doing a better job than the clerks of the course when you first asked 10 years ago. And, you know, who knows whether that's the case. I think what you can affect is retrospective changes to the going description so that in the form book it is accurate when somebody goes and has a look at it trying to have a punt next time the horse runs.
Well, yeah, that's another thing we're calling for. If that ground is changed to heavy in the results, then people looking at the winners of those first two races can see who handled the ground and who didn't when they next look at whether that's Aintree or next season or years ahead. And that's not happening now either, as you pointed out, and that's something else we're asking them to do. Basically, one of our tasks is to get better data for punters overall, and this is part of it.
I tell you what I do think, Sean. The going stick, okay? So when you say to somebody, why can't we just use the going stick, and then that'll just cut out all doubt, they always say to you, well, you see, different types of soil at different race courses means that you can't really compare like with like. It's like comparing apples with oranges. But I will always say to them, not at the same courses, not. You know, if you standardise your going stick numbers to your course, so you say, right, at Cheltenham, 3.7 is a heavy, 4.2 is a soft, 5 is a good to soft, 6.5 is good, 7.9 is good to firm, whatever it is, then that's always the case on new course, old course. Whereas at Beverley, 5 is a heavy, 7 is a soft, whatever. Those tracks are different, but you can standardise them surely to the tracks themselves. The soil at Cheltenham's not going to change from this year to next year.
I would agree, though I can't pretend I'm a scientist and then that I understand these things particularly. I don't. What we just want to see is better going descriptions. And we'd like to see a little bit more fire in the belly, if you like, of people trying to do something. Show the punters who are contributing towards the sport and who are under fire from the affordability checks on all angles, that you actually care about us and that you're actually out there trying to do the correct thing. And it seems a little bit, we'll get on with it one day. And there doesn't seem to be a new rush. So we sort of felt morally obliged, having received numerous messages moaning about going descriptions, to publicise something and say, can you go and do something, please?
Right, that was Sean Trivers, who's the chair of the Horse Race Betters Forum. I mean, it sounds quite simple when he puts it like that, doesn't it?
Well, it is simple. I mean, it is frustrating because it's misleading for fans of the sport to go into a horse's profile and think, well, this horse has never run on heavy or never run beyond good to soft or never tried good to firm. And then, you know, if you dig a bit deeper, you find that actually they have. I mean, you know, personally, that's one of the reasons why I use Timeform, because it gives me a better idea of what the going actually was. And you can't have a system whereby the fans of the sport and growing fans of the sport, people who are developing their understanding, are being given misleading information. We're talking about the importance of data and how that will incentivize more young people to be interested in the sport. Well, you know, this is pretty data 101, isn't it? It's really, really basic stuff. So yeah, absolutely, the form book should be amended to reflect what the ground actually was. And the point also that Sean made is that this does not come as a surprise. The widespread dissatisfaction amongst fans and bettors on the sport, which, you know, just to remind the sport, this is how we get our income. They are fundamental to its future. And they have put on record for a very, very, very long time, both with the British Horse Racing Authority and the Racecourse Association, how dissatisfied they are about the accuracy of their going reports. The BHA and the RCA and the individual racecourses know this is an issue, and not enough improvement, brackets if any, has been made.
Marcus Huster, who was one of the most powerful figures in South African horse racing, one of the most significant figures for a time in global horse racing, died yesterday at the age of 63 in Hermanus, in his home in South Africa. The circumstances surrounding his death are extremely disturbing, and this brings to a pretty grisly close one of the most sorry chapters in the sport and in business in South Africa for many years. Robin Lowe, award-winning South African journalist, is with me now. Robin, just tell us exactly what happened yesterday.
Well, Nick, thank you so much for having me. At this stage, details are still a little sketchy, and I'm sure for the family and everyone who knew him, you know, they will probably keep a lot of those private, but it unfortunately seems as though he did choose to take his own life sort of late yesterday afternoon. Again, we're waiting for confirmed reports, but one of them seems to indicate that he'd taken himself for a walk and that he was found by some local residents on one of the cliff paths in Hermanus. Paramedics and authorities were called to the scene. It seems as though he was still alive at the time. So he was attended to, and they did take him to a local hospital, but he unfortunately succumbed to his injuries at hospital. So very sadly, Mr. Huster passed away late yesterday afternoon.
He had at one point an extremely successful business career, but that had collapsed in recent years. Just tell us the sanctions that he was facing before he decided to end his life.
Well, he's been under a lot of public scrutiny, as well as various financial authorities that have been investigating the events that led to the collapse of Steinhoff. I'm probably not as well versed on the business world side of things, so I'm unfamiliar with, you know, exactly all of the pressures that would have been brought to bear on him. But the latest one, which I suspect may have been the pivotal one leading up to yesterday, was the fact that the Financial Sector Conduct Authority issued a penalty of $475 million on him earlier this week. And it sounds as though they were wanting to arrest him, it would have been today. And I suspect that, unfortunately, I wasn't close to him, but given everything that he's been through over the last few years, you know, this may well just have been the straw that broke the camel's back, and perhaps this was what, you know, led to his decision.
Just how big a player in global horse racing was Marcus Euster in his pomp? Well, we remember those black, green and yellow starred colours. We saw them with the horses trained by William Haggis and others in the UK. He was involved in the sponsorship at the Derby Festival for quite some time as well. And how big a figure was he in South Africa?
He was dominant. It was an incredible rise to dominance, really. He started out as a small owner, but in one of those things which racing people will know, sometimes it's a good thing to get lucky, sometimes not so much. But he was lucky to be involved with a very good horse very early on, a horse called National Emblem, that he owned as part of a syndicate. National Emblem became a champion racehorse and then also went on to be a stud sire. So, you know, it was one of those sort of lightning strikes kind of moments, and the bug bit quite hard. And from there, Marcus expanded his ownership and got into breeding. And then he also got involved in the administrative side of things through our ownership association, the Racing Association, and then from there onto the Pumalela board. And this sort of, his rise to prominence in the racing industry was almost parallel with his business, his rise and success in business. So as he became more wealthy and more successful, you know, he also became similarly ambitious on the race course and the breeding shed. So he then also expanded his interests into a sales company, and then eventually internationally as well. He was importing bloodstock, he was also buying horses abroad and racing horses abroad. Some of the horses that he raced locally also went and raced successfully in Dubai and Hong Kong, Variety Club being one of our real sort of standout stars. So he was everywhere. It's always a big blow when something like that happens. And, you know, it's a very, very difficult time for everyone. We have a huge amount of sympathy for everyone around him. It's not been easy. You know, and a lot of people have been quite negative about it, but I think he helped as many people as he harmed as well. People forget about the incredible generosity. He was famous for being very kind to people after a success. I did mention Variety Club earlier. One of the lovely things that he did was he kept the breeder of the horse very involved throughout Variety Club's career, took him on all of the trips when Variety Club was campaigning abroad. So he had an incredibly generous side to him as well. And, you know, as I said, it's a difficult time, but I think it's important to remember the good as well.
Robin, thank you for your time.
Thank you so much.
Journalist Robin Lowe there on the untimely death of Marcus Euster in South Africa. To Australia now. Our Australian racing is brought to you in association with OzHorse, the power of passion. Invest where racing matters. Well, we do like to monitor the progress of Brits abroad on this show. And I remember a few years ago ringing up a young British trainer who'd, I think she'd had maybe her second winner in Australia. Thought this was quite nice. Anyway, don't know whatever happened to her. I think she was called Annabelle Neesham, something like that. Anyway, hopefully history repeats itself, because the chuckle you can hear in the background is that of Dominic Sutton, who I think I last interviewed when he won a hunter chase at Newbury when he was about 19 on offshore account in his dad's colours. It must have been 11 or 12 years ago. He's just trained his first winner in Pakenham in Australia in the same pink, blue and white silks, a two-year-old called Feroce, who looks a real prospect. Dom's with me now. Dom, tell us about the journey from a Newbury hunter chase to training a two-year-old winner at Pakenham, and what might it promise for the future?
thoughts?
Yeah, look, it's been a long journey, Nick. Obviously, yeah, going back to Newbury, that was many years ago, and I quickly learned after that the race riding wasn't for me. Just through a lack of probably ability and also my size. So I quickly learned that, you know, I had to look down other avenues to sort of pursue a career in racing. And decided after I finished school that it was time to go and travel and learn about the racing industry in different parts of the world, and landed in Australia and worked for Chris Waller for a good year and a half. And that was an amazing experience. Worked with some top quality animals. I remember walking into his barn in Melbourne, and I think 15 out of the 25 he had in work were all group listed class horses. And I thought, gee, it must be easy to get a group or listed horse here in Australia. Loved my time with him, and then sort of progressed over to the Corstens camp, where they very kindly offered me a position in a foreman's role, and sort of just learned the ropes and gained as much experience as I could in different avenues and aspects of the racing industry, and worked my way up to the assistant trainer there for the past sort of 6-7 years, and most recently was fortunate enough to be able to go on a world tour with the Astrologist, which was great experience, and was able to meet a lot of good people along the way, and it just came to the right stage to sort of take the venture out on my own. And as you mentioned it, in my dad's silks, having our first winner today was very special.
And you and your dad rode at the same time as well, didn't you?
Yeah, in fact, I think we actually rode against each other. I think he actually finished in front of me at a point to point, so we won't talk too long about that. We both went around the point to point circuit, and a horse called Offshore Account, which you mentioned just before we came on air, was a horse that was very special to both of us. He managed to run third round the Fox Hunters at Aintree on him, and he also gave me my first success under rules at Newbury, as you commented earlier.
So now, how well set up are you? What does the barn look like, and what's the sort of plan for the immediate future?
Yeah, so we're a small sort of select group of horses at the moment. We've got 6 in work down here at Pakenham. Got probably about 15, 16 on the books. I was fortunate enough to have a bit of backing to be able to go to the yearling sales and purchase a couple of younger horses. We've actually made the decision to relocate away from Pakenham and head to Ballarat. I was very fortunate enough that they approached me with a barn which was big enough for me to grow my numbers in. Obviously, it's a great facility, a lot of good horses and trainers up there, with the likes of Kieran Maher and Matt Kamani, the McAvoys, Archie Alexander. There's a very much a UK flavour up there as well. So we're going to be making the move at the end of the month. And we're just trying to grow at a steady rate. I think it's important to do everything at the right timing. We don't want to get too big too fast. But taking each step as it comes. Obviously, getting the first winner ticked off was a big box to tick, and hopefully we can just keep sort of building at a nice rate and get some nice horses through the door.
A lot of Australian trainers, particularly young Australian trainers, are now seeking UK investment and are getting quite a bit of UK investment. Is that the case with you? Are you finding owners want to have horses in Australia?
Yeah, definitely. And that's been a big factor as to why I was able to go out and venture on my own, was because of the UK support. Obviously, I'm fortunate enough that, my dad's well connected in the UK, and a few guys have jumped on board and have really wanted to start investing into Australian racing. Obviously, it's very prosperous with the prize money. And I've been fortunate enough to have that link and connection where it's helped me sort of get this off the ground.
And this horse looks a nice horse as well for Roche. First time out, 2-year-old. So to win with a juvenile debutant is something in itself. Is he up to a significant level, do you think?
I think so. I think he's a very nice horse in the making. He's still very raw. You probably would have seen yesterday. He's still working out where to put his legs. He's a big gangly horse. He's only going to get better once he feels into his frame. But yeah, he was on the wrong leg coming around the bend and took Billy Egan a couple of strides just to gather him and get him balanced. And I think once he puts it all together, he's going to be a horse that can hopefully take us to some nice races into his three-year-old career. I think whatever he does now as a two-year-old is just a plus. He's just a frame. And once he feels out and matures mentally, I think he should hopefully be able to take us to some nice races.
First of many, I've no doubt. Dom, thanks for talking to us today.
Cheers. Thanks, Nick.
Dom Sutton there. Good luck to him in his future endeavours. And our final port of call today is to Dubai, with just 8 days until the Dubai World Cup. Laura King has been out and about meeting some of the people that make the racing scene in the Emirates tick.
Think Dubai-based jockey and you think of Tiger O'Shea. The Irishman has been a fixture in the Emirates since 2002. But how did it all start?
Very lucky. I was riding for Michael Halford and that year for the Champion Apprentice winner. I was informed by Michael Halford and Yubi de Burg that his Highness, the late great Sheikh Hamdan bin Rashid Al Maktoum, was sponsoring an all-expense trip paid for the Champion Apprentice of that year. And I think because it was so tight, there was four or five of us on level par with like three meetings to go. So, it put very lot of excitement on the championship of that year. And thankfully, I came out on top by one winner. And that was 2001, and came out and worked for four of His Highness's trainers. And obviously, had a lot of rides for His Highness. And yes, it went from there and never looked back.
23 years later, Tiger's ridden almost 800 winners in the UAE, and is within clutching distance of his 12th championship after a season-long tussle with Conor Beasley. At the age of 42, he remains as hungry as ever.
I suppose when you get older, anytime when you reach a birthday or whatever, you think, you can't do it forever. So, I've been very lucky. I've rode for a lot of good people, and I'd like to think I've worked hard along the way. And 11 championships. I wouldn't have told you in January the 1st of this year, I was 16 off the lead. So I've had a very good January and February, and there's a lot of racing left. There's 5 weeks left, so it's very competitive, as you know. And obviously with the Maidan meetings and the international horses running, it's super tough to have winners, so they all count. And we'll give it a kick now in the belly, and hopefully plenty more wins on the board.
In his 2 decades in Dubai, Tiger's ridden for pretty much every major trainer in the Emirates. But who has been the biggest influence on his career?
Well, I suppose His Highness Sheikh Hamdan bin Rashid was first and foremost, because he brought me to this wonderful country. And, Erwin Sharpe in the early years, he showed me Dubai basically, and the tracks and everything about how to ride the tracks. And, I got a great grounding there. And, I came as a young kid. I hardly went to England from Ireland, let alone go to Dubai. So, Erwin was a major part. And as I said, I've been very lucky. Satish Seymour, who are riding for his nephew now, Bupa predominantly, and the Thoroughbred front, I've always picked up spare rides over the last 20 years for Zabil Stable. So, they were always a major help as well. And I suppose in the last 10 years or so, Ernst Ortel, first of all, and Alice Sale with the Arabians, that brought me to different level riding Arabians. They had very, very good Arabians. And also when I got the job as retained rider for Khalifa Al Nabuda 5 years ago now, again, won Kayla Classics for him, runner up last year, ridden any amount of winners for him, and very, very fortunate to be riding, for such a passionate owner breeder. Probably one of the biggest, if not the biggest owner breeder of Arabian race horses in the world.
With only two Thoroughbred Group 1s outside of the World Cup meeting, top-level successes are hard to come by in Dubai. Tiger managed one, however, on the lovable Switzerland in the 2022 Dubai Golden Shaheen. So, surely he makes his Horsey Hall of Fame.
Danador was my first ever winner here for the Maktoum family and an Arabian race way back in 2001. So he was special. He got the ball rolling. And I suppose T-Bird was my first Carnival winner back in the day for Erwin Sharpe. And Mizna was my first World Cup night winner, 2007. So then, Switzerland, I suppose, winning Group 1 Golden Shaheen was massive for me as well.
Tiger isn't about to hang up his boots anytime soon, But when he does, there could be another O'Shea in the jockey's room.
My youngest son, Aaron, tells me he's going to be a trainer. I think he'd make a better agent. He tells me when I mess up and riding the wrong horse. And Dara's flying it on the ponies, and he's fearless. So he's got a few offers already, people out here to when he for his claim when he starts riding. So I always said when Dara starts, I'll stop. So that'll be another 4 or 5 years, hopefully. And look, he's mad keen at the moment.
The start of an O'Shea riding dynasty? You heard it here first.
Well, thank you to a rich and varied lineup of guests today from all across the globe. Lydia Hislop, the first of them and the final one of them, and hopefully with something straightforward like a tip for the Lincoln that wins or something like that.
Liberty Lane, I think, running for the first time as a gelding, has got a win over the course and distance at Doncaster from last September, has got a lot of ability and is the kind of horse I think that could, you know, go on quite markedly this season. Already has the capability of winning off his current mark, but I think there's a lot more to him. I fear Awal, who ran really well when second to Migration, who also runs in the race this year. So the first and second from last year, re-opposing. Awal's got a first time tongue tie, loves this kind of ground, but I just feel there's something pretty classy about Liberty Lane, and I think Carl Burke might be able to unlock even more of it this season.
Migration trainer Devon Menuzier will be among my guests on Luck on Sunday this week.
Oh, fantastic. I love David, and I love his training of Migration as well.
You're definitely going to be watching. You know why?
Why is that?
Not only Devon Menuzier, but also your favourite couple in racing.
Is that Lucinda Russell and Peter Scudamore?
Correct. And this week's biggest newsmaker joining me from a safe distance.
And who is that?
Doctor.
Oh, Richard Newland. Oh, right. Okay. Well, that will be entertaining.
Hopefully. See you Sunday morning. See you much sooner than that. And thank you for today. And thank you everyone for listening. Charlotte will be back this evening and I will be back on Monday. Have a great weekend. Bye for now. You've been listening to Nick Luck Daily, brought to you by Timeform, the trusted source of racing data and analysis, by the Racehorse Owners Association, and by the Racing App in partnership with FitStairs.